It was not Nina Zenick. She was Mila Yanderstadt, a girl whose livelihood might very well depend on the favor of Jarl Broom. But Broom's focus was on Hannah. His face softened when he looked at his daughter.
"Hannah," he said, stepping forward and embracing her. "You're looking hearty."
Hannah hunched a little more.
"Thank you, Papa."
"Your form would soften if you would leave off riding so much."
"I'm sorry, Papa."
He sighed.
"I know you are."
His gaze shifted to Nina, who bowed her head and turned her eyes to the floor demurely.
"And this is your new teacher? She's young enough to be a student here."
"She's serving as a guide to the Zemini tradesmen who arrived last week," said Hannah.
"So the well mother tells me," said Broom, stalking toward Nina. "A stranger arrives with two foreigners, and only days later the security at the factory is breached. An unlikely coincidence."
Nina looked at him with what she hoped was bewildered dismay. Broom snatched the tip of her chin and tilted her face up. Whoever had sewn the skin back onto his head had done so with considerable skill, but his golden hair was gone and there was no hiding the scar that circled his skull like the fat pink tail of a rat. A Grisha healer or tailor could have faded it, but of course then he'd have had to let one of them near his head. Nina wanted to meet his incisive gaze with a glare of her own. Instead, she allowed her eyes to fill with tears. Broom frowned.
"How old are you?"
18, sir.
"You were widowed young."
"I have been unlucky."
His lip curled slightly.
"Why do you tremble so?"
"I have had little cause to be in the presence of great men."
Broom's brows rose, but she didn't miss the flash of satisfaction in his eyes.
"So this is what Commander Broom liked. Flattery, timidity, fear."
When she'd met him last, she'd been bold and flirtatious. Now she understood her mistake.
"Where did you learn Zemini?"
he asked. "My husband ran a small business shipping frozen goods and fish. He traded frequently with the Zemini. I had a talent for it and took over the communications."
"And how did he die?"
"Lost to the waters."
A tear rolled down her cheek. Nina could not have asked for better timing. Broom's eyes tracked its progress almost hungrily.
"A shame."
He released Nina's chin and stepped back.
"I'll want to question the Zemini traders," he told the well mother.
"What about my lessons, Papa?"
Hannah asked.
"Your lessons?" Broom said thoughtfully. "Yes, I think the influence of a girl with country manners might be good for you, Hannah. You may continue."
Nina sank into another curtsy.
"Thank you, sir,"
she said, looking up at him through wet lashes.
"It is an honor."
As Broom and Hannah left the room to chat privately, Nina curtsied to the well mother and turned to go.
"I know what you're up to," said the well mother.
Nina froze with her hand on the doorknob.
"What do you mean?"
"Commander Broom is happily married to a woman of noble birth."
Nina blinked and almost burst out laughing.
"Why would that concern me?"
The well mother's eyes slitted.
"I doubt it would concern you at all. I knew there was more to your motives than a simple teaching position."
"I only wish to make a living."
The well mother clucked in disbelief.
"You aim to land a wealthy provider. You may have the good commander fooled with your wide eyes and wobbly lip, but you are no honest woman."
"And you are the worst kind of hypocrite," Nina thought, anger flaring. This woman had dosed young girls and women with parem, or some equivalent. She'd put on her pious little pinafore and walked the halls of that factory with her cursed drug, helping soldiers make slaves.
"When those girls go missing, I'm going to make sure Jarl Broom blames you. Then we'll see how you enjoy the good commander's attentions."
But all she said was,
"Commander Broom is old enough to be my father. and wise enough to resist your clumsy allure, I'll warrant. But I'll be watching.
Nina shook her head with false concern.
You have been cloistered here too long, well, mother, if your thoughts turn so readily to sin.
How dare you? Nina fluffed her skirts primly over her toes.
I'm not sure it's an entirely wholesome atmosphere for a girl like Hannah.
A shame, Nina said as she turned to go.
But I will pray for you.
She left the well mother red-cheeked and sputtering. As much as Nina enjoyed baiting the well mother, she was glad of the woman's suspicions.
What's the easiest way to steal a man's wallet?
Kaz Brekker had once explained.
Tell him you're going to steal his watch.
If that sour-mouthed crone thought Nina's goal was to become a rich man's mistress, then she'd be distracted from their real plan.
And what if Broom is bluffing?
What if he knows exactly who I am? Nina had been fooled by Broom once before and had nearly lost her life in the process. This time she would be more cautious. When she tangled with Jarl Broom again, she did not intend to leave him standing. But she wasn't prepared for the storm awaiting her in the classroom.
What was that? Hannah railed.
Corey was nowhere to be found, and Hannah paced back and forth, her pinafore billowing behind her.
Quivering like a leaf in a storm. Crying like some kind of frightened child. That wasn't you.
Nina felt a sudden surge of anger. What she'd seen at the fort. The shock of meeting Broom again. The crimes of the well mother. It was all too much.
You barely know me, she snapped. I know you're brave enough to want to help your sister and reckless enough to break into a military stronghold to do it. I know you're clever enough to dupe a room full of drunk hunters and generous enough to help a desperate friend. Or is that all an act, too?
Nina clenched her fists. I'm trying to make sure I survive, that both of us survive. Your father... I know his reputation. He's a ruthless man.
He's had to be.
Nina wanted to scream. How could fierce-spirited Hannah be Broom's daughter? And why couldn't she see what he was?
If he knew you were Grisha, what would he do?
Hannah turned toward the window.
I don't know.
What if he knew I was trying to help you?
Hannah shrugged. I don't know, she repeated.
You know, Nina thought. You know what that bigoted bastard would do,
but you're too afraid to admit it.
Nina wanted to take her by the shoulders and shake her. She wanted to pull Hannah onto a horse and ride until they reached the shore. But she couldn't think about any of that. Not if they were going to free the girls in the fort.
Otto Wasi, we fight.
And Nina knew fighting meant using all the tools at her disposal, even Hannah's guilt.
You owe it to your father to keep this secret.
Nina felt sick saying those words, aware of the effect they would have. Hannah owed Broom nothing, but Nina forced herself to continue.
If he knew you were Grisha, it would put him in an impossible position. His reputation and his career would be at tremendous risk.
Hannah slumped at the desk and put her head in her hands.
You think I don't realize that?
Nina crouched down before her.
Hannah, look at me.
Nina waited, and at last Hannah looked up. Her vibrant eyes were dry but anguished, and Nina knew the pain was not for herself but for the embarrassment she'd cause her father.
This country does terrible things to its women and to its men.
Your father thinks the way he does because he was raised to.
But I can't help him. I can't fix him. I can help my sister. I can help you. And I'll do what I have to in order to make that possible. If that means batting my lashes at your father and convincing him I'm a model of Fjordan womanhood, I'll do it.
It's disgusting. You looked at my father as if he were an incarnation of Jell.
I looked at your father the way he wants to be looked at, like a hero.
Hannah ran her calloused thumb down the length of the old wooden desk.
Is that what you do with me?
No, said Nina, and that at least was the truth.
She had told Hannah countless lies, but she'd never flattered, never manipulated her in that way. When I said you were talented, I meant it. When I said you were glorious, I meant that too. Hannah met her gaze, and for a moment Nina felt as if they weren't stuck in this classroom or even this country. They were someplace better. They were someplace free. "Our first job is always to survive," she said. "I won't apologize for it." Hannah's lips twitched.
"Have you always been this sure of yourself?"
Nina shrugged.
"Yes."
"And your husband didn't complain?" "He complained," Nina said. And suddenly she had to look away, because it was not some fictional merchant who had come to mind, but Matthias with his strict propriety and his disapproving glower and his loving, generous heart. "He complained all the time."
"Was he quick to anger?" Hannah asked.
Nina shook her head and pressed her palms to her eyes, unable to stop the tears that came, not wanting to. Saints, she was tired.
"No.
We didn't always agree." She smiled, tasting salt on her lips. "In fact, we almost never agreed.
But he loved me. And I loved him."
Hannah reached across the desk and let her fingers brush Nina's hand.
"I had no right to ask."
"It's okay," said Nina. "The hurt just still catches me by surprise. It's a sneaky little podge."
Hannah leaned back, studying her.
"I've never met anyone like you."
Nina knew she should lower her head, make some comment about reining in her boldness of spirit, demonstrate that she gave a damn about Fjord and ways. Instead, she sniffled and said,
"Of course you haven't. I'm spectacular."
Hannah laughed.
"I would cut off a thumb for a thimbleful of your confidence."
Nina brushed her tears away and squeezed Hannah's hand, felt the warm press of her palm, the calluses of her fingers.
Hands that could sew, string a bow, soothe a sick child.
It felt good to take this small bit of comfort, even if it also felt like she was stealing.
"I'm glad I met you, Hannah," Nina said.
"Do you mean that?"
She nodded, surprised at how much she did. Hannah might not be loud or reckless with her words, she might bow her head to her father and the well mother, but she had never let Fjorda break her. Despite her curtsies and her talk of family honor, she had remained defiant. Hannah sighed.
"Good, because my father wants you to join us for dinner tonight after he tours the factory."
"When does he return to the capital?"
"Tomorrow morning."
Hannah's gaze was steady, knowing.
"You're planning something."
"Yes," said Nina.
"You knew I would." "I won't act until he's gone. But I'm going to need your help." "What do you want me to do?"
"A great deal. And none of it will be easy."
"I want you to become who your father always hoped you'd be."
Chapter 25. Zoya.
Nikolai was getting better at calling the monster, but his mood seemed to be growing darker. He was quieter and more distant at the end of each visit with Elisaveta. Though it was Zoya who had to face drowning. By now, they didn't think Elisaveta had any real intention of killing her, but the monster still seemed to believe the threat was real. A fact that didn't sit well with Zoya. Thanks to her lessons with Juris, she suspected she could break through the amber walls the saint erected around her, and when the sap began to rise around her legs, it was hard not to try. But she wasn't there to prove her strength, only to help Nikolai make the monster rise.
"From general of the Grisha army to bait for a monster."
It was not a position she enjoyed, and only the progress she'd made in Juris's lair kept her temper from getting the best of her. Today she had arrived at Elisaveta's spire early. Yuri and Nikolai hadn't shown up, and the saint herself was nowhere to be found. Or was she? The great golden chamber hummed with the sound of insects. If Juris was to be believed, they were all her. 6 sides to the chamber. 6 sides to each amber panel that comprised its soaring walls. Was this why the little palace had been built on a hexagonal plan? Zoya had seen the shape repeated in Grisha buildings, their tombs, their training places. Had it all begun with Elisaveta's hive? There were tunnels leading from each of the 6 walls. Zoya wondered where they led.
You were one of his students, weren't you?
Zoya jumped at the sound of Elisaveta's voice. The saint stood by the table where the thorn tree she'd grown still sprawled over the surface. Zoya knew Elisaveta meant the darkling, though student was not the right word. Worshipper, or acolyte, would have been more accurate.
I was a soldier in the Second Army, and under his command.
Elisaveta slanted her a glance.
You need not play coy with me, Zoya. I knew him too.
Zoya's surprise must have shown because Elisaveta said,
Oh, yes. All of us crossed paths with him at one time or another. I met him when he had only just begun his service to the Ravkin kings, when I was still in my youth.
Zoya felt a shiver at the thought of just how ancient Elisaveta must be. Her connection to the making at the heart of the world had granted her eternity. Was she really ready to reject it?
Did he know what you were?
Zoya asked instead. What you could do?
No, said Elisaveta. I barely did. But he knew I had great power, and he was drawn to that.
He always was. The Darkling prized power above every other trait. Zoya sometimes worried if she might be very much the same.
Count yourself lucky, she said. If he had known the extent of your gifts, he would have pursued you until he could use them for himself.
Elisaveta laughed.
You underestimate me, young Zoya.
Or you underestimated him. The saint gave a skeptical bob of her head.
Perhaps. What was he like then?
Zoya could not resist asking.
Arrogant, idealistic, beautiful.
Elisaveta smiled ruefully, her fingers trailing the spine of the thorn tree. It curled to meet her like a cat arching its back.
I met him many times throughout the years, and he adopted many guises to hide his true self. But the faces he chose were always lovely. He was vain. Or smart. People value beauty. They can't help but respond to it.
You would know, said Elisaveta.
The fairy stories really aren't true, are they? They promise that goodness or kindness will make you lovely. But you are neither good nor kind.
Zoya shrugged.
Should I aspire to be? Your king values such things.
And should Zoya seek his approval? Pretend to be something other than she was? My king values my loyalty and my ability to lead an army. He will have his wife to smile and simper and cuddle orphans.
You'd give him up so readily.
Now Zoya's brows rose in surprise.
He isn't mine to keep. There is a reason I use you and not the monk to provoke his demon.
The king would fight to save anyone, princess or peasant in the field.
And that's all there is to it. I see the way his eyes follow you.
Was something in Zoya pleased at that? Something foolish and proud?
Men have been watching me my whole life. It's not worth taking note of.
Careful, young Zoya. It is one thing to be looked at by a mere man, quite another thing to garner the attention of a king.
Attention was easy to come by. Men looked at her and wanted to believe they saw goodness beneath her armor. A kind girl, a gentle girl who would emerge if only given the chance. But the world was cruel to kind girls, and she'd always appreciated that Nikolai didn't ask that of her. Why would he? Nikolai spoke of partnerships and allies. But he was romantic. He wanted love of a kind Zoya could not give and would never receive. Maybe the thought stung, but that prick of pain, the uneasy sense that something had been lost, belonged to a girl, not a soldier. Zoya glanced down one of the tunnels. It seemed darker than the others. The smell of honey and sap that emanated from it was not quite right, sweetness punctured by the taint of rot. It might have been her imagination, but the bees even sounded different here, less the buzz of busy insects than the lazy, glutted hum of battlefield flies sated on the dead. "What's down there?" Zoya asked. "What's wrong with them?"
"The bees are every part of me," said Elisabetta. "Every triumph, every sadness. This part of the hive is weary. It is tired of life.
That bitterness will spread to the rest of the hive until all existence will lose its savor.
That is why I must leave the fold, why I will take on a mortal life."
"Are you really ready to give up your power?" Zoya asked. She couldn't quite fathom it. Elisabetta nodded at the dark chamber.
"Most of us can hide our greatest hurts and longings. It's how we survive each day. We pretend the pain isn't there, that we are made of scars instead of wounds. The hive does not grant me the luxury of that lie. I cannot go on this way. None of us can."
The thorny vine curling beneath Elisabetta's hand suddenly sprouted with white blossoms that turned pink and then blood red before Zoya's eyes. "Quince," she asked, thinking of the tales of beasts and maidens she had heard as a child, of Sankt Felix and his apple boughs. What had Juris said?
"Sometimes the stories are rough on the details."
Elisabetta nodded.
"Most women suffer thorns for the sake of the flowers. But we who would wield power adorn ourselves in flowers to hide the sting of our thorns."
"Be sweeter. Be gentler. Smile when you are suffering." Zoya had ignored these lessons, often to her detriment. She was all thorns.
"Your king is late," said Elisabetta.
Zoya found she wasn't sorry. She did not want to drown today. Juris sensed Zoya's mood when she entered the cavern.
"You've been to see Elisabetta," he said,
setting aside the tiny obsidian horse he had been carving to add to his herd.
"I can smell it on you."
Zoya nodded, reaching for the axes she had come to favor. She liked the weight and balance of them, and they reminded her of Tamar. Was she homesick? She'd lost track of time here. No food, no rest. Hours bled into days. "Everyone is so concerned with the naming of their wounds and the tending of them," she said.
"It's tiresome."
Juris gave a noncommittal grunt.
"No weapons today."
Zoya scowled. She'd been looking forward to working through her melancholy with a little combat. "Then what?"
"I had hoped by now you would be further along."
Zoya planted her fists on her hips. "I'm doing brilliantly."
"You can still only summon wind. Water and fire should also be at your command."
"Grisha power doesn't work that way."
"You think a dragon cannot control fire?"
So, Joris was claiming to be an Inferni as well as a squalor? "And I suppose you are a tide-maker, too."
"Water is my weakest element, I confess. I come from a very wet island. I've never been fond of rain."
You're saying I could summon from all orders.
What have we been playing at, if that is not our aim?
It didn't seem possible. But in only a short time, Joris had shown her that the boundaries of Grisha power were more flexible than she'd ever have believed.
Are we not all things?
They were words she remembered from long ago, from the writings of Ilya Morozova, one of the most powerful Grisha ever known. He had theorized that there should be no Grisha orders, no divisions between powers, if the science was small enough. If all matter could be broken down to the same small parts, then a talented enough Grisha could be able to manipulate those parts. Morozova had hoped that creating and combining amplifiers was the way to greater Grisha power. But what if there was another way?
Show me.
Joris shifted, his bones cracking and reforming as he took on his dragon form.
Climb on.
Zoya hesitated, staring up at the massive beast before her.
It is not an offer I make to just anyone, Storm Witch.
And if a foul mood strikes you and you decide to cast me from your back? Zoya asked as she laid her hands on the scales at his neck. They were sharp and cool to the touch.
Then I have made you strong enough to survive the fall.
Reassuring. She pressed her boot into his flank and hitched herself onto the ridge of his neck. It wasn't comfortable. Dragons had not been made for riding.
Hold on, he said.
Oh, is that what I'm supposed to— Zoya gasped and clung tight as Joris's wings flapped once, twice, and he launched himself into the colorless sky. The wind rushed against her face, lifting her hair, making her eyes water. She had flown before, had traveled on Nikolai's flying contraptions. This was nothing like that. She could feel every shift Joris made with the currents as he rode the wind, the movement of the muscles beneath his scales, even the way his lungs expanded with each breath. She could feel the force of a stampede in the body beneath her, the heaving power of a storm-tossed sea. There was nothing to see in the Saint's Fold. It was all barren earth and flat horizon. Maybe that was maddening for Joris, to fly for miles and yet go nowhere. But Zoya didn't care. She could stay this way forever with nothing but sky and sand surrounding her. She laughed, her heart leaping. This was the magic she'd been promised as a child, the dream that all those fairy stories had offered and never delivered. She wished the girl she'd been could have lived this.
Open the door, Zoya.
The dragon's words rumbled through his body.
Open your eyes.
There's nothing to see. But that wasn't entirely true. Up ahead, she glimpsed a jagged blot on the landscape. She knew instantly what it was. Turn around, she demanded. I want to go back.
You know you cannot.
Turn around! The strength of the storm filled her bones and she tried to move the dragon's head.
Zoya of the Lost City, he said. Open the door.
The dragon swooped and dove for the ruins of Novokrybirsk. It felt like falling. Zoya was the stone and there was no bottom to the well, no end to the emptiness inside her. Do not look back at me. The past came rushing at her. Why now? Because of Elisaveta's talk of wounds? Joris's taunts? The torment of being drowned each day as Nikolai grew more distant? She did not want to think of Liliana or all that she'd lost. There was only the wind and the darkness before her. The dead gray sky above her, the ruins of a lost city below. And yet it was the memory of her mother's face that filled Zoya's mind. Sabina's beauty had been astonishing, the kind that stopped men and women alike on the street. But she had made a bad bargain. She had married for love, a handsome Suli boy with broad shoulders and few prospects. For a time they were poor but happy, and then they were just poor.
As they starved and scraped by, the affection between them wasted away, too. Long days of work and long months of winter wore at Sabina's beauty and her spirit. She had little love to give to the daughter she bore. Zoya worked hard for her mother's affection. She was always first in her lessons, always made sure to eat only half of her supper and give Sabina the rest. She was silent when her mother complained of headaches, and she stole peaches for Sabina from the Duke's orchards.
"You could be whipped for that," her mother said disapprovingly.
But she ate the peaches, one after another, sighing contentedly, until her stomach turned and she vomited them all beside the woodpile. Everything changed when Zoya caught the eye of Valentin Grenkin, a wealthy carriage maker from Stelt. He was the richest man for 100 miles, a widower twice over and 63 years old. Zoya was 9. She did not want to be a bride. But she did not want to displease her mother, who petted her and cooed at her as she had never done before. For the first time, Sabina seemed happy. She sang in the kitchen and cooked elaborate meals with the gifts of meat and vegetables that Valentin Grenkin sent. The night before the wedding, Sabina made orange cakes and laid out the elaborate pearl kokoshnik and little gold lace wedding gown Zoya's bridegroom had provided. Zoya hadn't meant to cry, but she hadn't been able to stop. Aunt Liliana had come all the way from Novokrybirsk for the ceremony. Or so Zoya had thought, until she heard her aunt pleading with Sabina to reconsider. Liliana was younger than Sabina, and rarely spoken of. She had left home with scant fanfare, and braved the deadly journey across the Shadow Fold to make a life for herself in the hardscrabble town of Novokrybirsk. It was a good place for a woman alone, where cheap prosperity could be had, and employers were so desperate for workers they gladly offered positions to women that would otherwise be reserved for men.
"He won't hurt her, Liliana," Sabina said sharply, as Zoya sat at the kitchen table, her bare feet brushing the wood slats of the floor,
the perfect circle of her untouched orange cake uneaten on the plate before her.
"He said he would wait for her to bleed." "Am I to applaud him?" Liliana demanded. "How will you protect her if he changes his mind? You are selling your own child." "We are all bought and sold. At least Zoya will fetch a price that will give her an easy life."
"Soon she will be old enough to be a soldier."
"And then what? We'll live off her meager pay? She'll serve until she's killed or injured so that she can go on to live alone and poor like you? I do well enough. Do you think I don't see your shoes tied together with string? Better to be a woman alone than a woman beholden to some old man who can't manage a wife his own age, and it was my choice to make. In a few years, Zoya will be old enough to make her own decisions. In a few years, Valentin Grenkin will have found some other pretty girl to occupy his interests."
"Good," retorted Liliana.
"Get out of my house," Sabina had seethed.
"I don't want to see you anywhere near the church tomorrow. Go back to your lonely rooms and your empty tea tins and leave my daughter alone."
Liliana had gone, and Zoya had run to her room and buried her face in her blankets, trying not to think of the words her mother had said or the images they'd conjured, praying with all the fervor in her heart that Liliana would come back, that the saints would save her, even as she soaked her pillows with tears. The next morning, Sabina had muttered angrily about Zoya's blotchy face as she dressed her in the little gold gown, and the attendants came to walk the bride to church. But Aunt Liliana was waiting at the altar beside a flummoxed priest. She refused to budge.
"Someone do something about this mad woman," Sabina had screamed. "She is no sister of mine."
Valentin Grenkin's men had seized Liliana, dragging her down the aisle.
"Lecher," Liliana had shouted at Grenkin. "Procurer," she yelled at Sabina.
Then she turned her damning eyes on the gathered townspeople.
"You are all witness to this. She's a child."
"Be silent," snarled Valentin Grenkin,
and when Liliana would not, he took up his heavy walking stick and cracked it against her skull. Liliana spat in his face. He hit her again. This time her eyes rolled back in her head.
Stop it! Cried Zoya, struggling in her mother's arms. Stop!
Criminal! Gasped Liliana. Filth!
Granken lifted his stick again.
Zoya understood that her aunt was going to be murdered before the church altar and no one was going to prevent it.
Because Valentin Granken was a rich, respected man. Because Liliana Garin was no one at all. Zoya screamed, the sound tearing from her. An animal cry. A wild gust of wind slammed into Valentin Granken, knocking him to the ground. His walking stick went clattering. Zoya fisted her hands, her fear and rage pouring from her in a flood. A churning wall of wind erupted around her and exploded into the eaves of the church, blowing the roof from its moorings with an ear-splitting crack. Thunder rumbled through a cloudless sky. The wedding guests bellowed their terror. Zoya's mother gazed at her daughter with frightened eyes, clutching the pew behind her as if she might collapse without its support. Liliana, one hand pressed to her bleeding head, cried,
You cannot sell her off now. She's Grisha. It's against the law. She is the property of the king and will go to school to train.
But no one was looking at Liliana. They were all staring at Zoya. Zoya ran to her aunt. She wasn't sure what she'd done or what it meant, only that she wanted to be as far away from this church and these people and the hateful man on the floor as she could get.
You leave us alone, she shouted at no one, at everyone. You let us go.
Valentin Granken whimpered as Zoya and Liliana hurried past him down the aisle. Zoya looked down at him and hissed. It was Liliana who took Zoya, still dressed in her wedding finery, to Osalta. They had no money for inns, so they slept in ditches and tucked into copses, shivering in the cold. Imagine we are on a ship, Liliana would say, and the waves are rocking us to sleep. Can you hear the masts creaking? We can use the stars to navigate.
Where are we sailing to?
Zoya had asked, sure she could hear something rustling in the woods. To an island covered in flowers, where the water in the streams tastes sweet as honey. Follow those two stars and steer us into port. Every night they traveled somewhere new, a coastline where silver seals barked on the shores, a jeweled grotto where they were greeted by the green-gilled Lord of the Deep, until at last they arrived at the capital and made the long walk to the palace gates. They were filthy by then, their hair tangled, Zoya's golden wedding dress torn and covered in dust. Liliana had ignored the guard's sneers as she made her requests, and she kept her back straight as she stood with Zoya outside the gates. They'd waited, and waited, and waited some more, shivering in the cold. Until at last, a young man in a purple kefta and an older woman dressed in red had come down to the gates.
What village are you from?
The woman had asked.
Pachina,
Liliana replied. The strangers murmured to each other for a moment about tests and when the last examiners had traveled through those parts. Then the woman had pushed up Zoya's sleeve and laid her palm on the bare skin of her arm. Zoya had felt a surge of power race through her. Wind rattled at the palace gates and whipped through the trees.
Ah, the woman had said on a long breath. What gift has arrived at our doorstep, looking so bedraggled? Come, we'll get you fed and warmed up.
Zoya had grabbed Liliana's hand, ready to begin their new adventure together. But her aunt had knelt and said gently,
I can go no further with you, little Zoya.
Why not?
I need to go home and tend to my chickens. You don't want them to get cold, do you?
Besides, she said, smoothing the hair away from Zoya's face, this is where you belong. Here they will see the jewel you are inside. Not just your pretty eyes.
For your troubles, the young man said, and dropped a coin into Liliana's palm.
Will you be all right?
Zoya asked her.
I will be fine. I will be better than fine, knowing you are safe.
Go now.
I can hear the chickens clucking. They're very cross with me.
Liliana kissed both of Zoya's cheeks.
Do not look back, Zoya. Do not look back at me, or your mother, or Pachina. Your future is waiting.
But Zoya looked back anyway, hoping for one last glimpse of her aunt waving through those towering gates. The trees had crowded the path. If Liliana was still there, Zoya could not see her. That very day, her training had begun. She'd been given a room at the little palace, started classes in language and reading, started to learn Shu, studied with the miserable wretch of a woman known only as Bagra in the hut by the lake. She'd written every week to her aunt, and every week received a long, newsy letter back with drawings of chickens in the corners and tales of the interesting traders who'd come through Novokhribirsk. By law, the parents of Grisha's students were paid a stipend, a rich fee to keep them in comfort. When Zoya learned this, she petitioned the bursar to send the money to her aunt in Novokhribirsk instead.
Liliana Garin is my guardian, she'd told him.
Are your parents dead, then?
Zoya had cast him a long look and said.
Not yet.
Even at 10, she'd had such cold command in her eyes that he'd simply put his pen to paper and said,
I will need an address and her full name.
It would be 6 years before Zoya made her first crossing of the Shadow Fold, as a junior squalor in the Second Army. The Grisha around her had been trembling, some even weeping as they'd entered the darkness, but Zoya had shown no fear, not even in the dark where no one would see her shake. When they'd arrived at Novokhribirsk, she had stepped down from the skiff, tossed her hair over her shoulder and said,
I'm going to find a hot bath and a proper meal.
It was only once she'd cleared the docks and left her companions behind that she'd broken into a run, her heart lifting, carrying her on light feet over the cobblestones to Liliana's small corner shop. She'd burst through the door, alarming Liliana's one customer, and Liliana had emerged from the back room, wiping her hands on her apron and saying,
What is causing such fuss?
When she saw Zoya, she'd pressed her hands to her heart, as if it might leap from her chest.
My girl, she said. My brilliant girl.
And then Zoya was hugging her aunt tight. They'd closed up the shop and Liliana had cooked them dinner and introduced Zoya to the child she'd taken in, whose parents hadn't made it back from their last crossing, a scrawny, snub-nosed girl named Leda, who demanded Zoya help her draw the little palace in extensive detail. They'd shelled hazelnuts by the fire and discussed the personalities of the chickens and all the gossip of the neighborhood. Zoya had told her aunt about her teachers, her friends, her chambers. She'd given Liliana gifts of calfskin boots, fur-lined gloves, and an expensive gilded mirror.
What will I do with this? Look at my old face, said Liliana.
Send it to your mother as a peace offering.
It's a gift for you, Zoya replied, so you can look into it each morning and see the most beautiful person I've ever known.
When the Darkling had used Alina to gain control of the fold and expand it, he'd destroyed Novokhribirsk to show his enemies his power. The darkness had consumed the city, turning its buildings to dust and its people to prey for the unnatural monsters that roamed its depths. In the wake of the disaster, all crossings had ceased, and it had taken weeks for news of the casualties to reach Khribirsk. The Second Army was in chaos, the Sun Summoner had disappeared or been killed, and the Darkling was said to have emerged somewhere in West Ravka. But Zoya did not care. She could only think of Liliana.
She'll be sitting in her little shop with Leda and the chickens, she told herself. All will be well.
Zoya waited and prayed to every saint, returning to the Khribirsk dry docks day after day, begging for news. And finally, when no one would help her, she'd commandeered a small skiff on her own and entered the fold with no one to protect her. She knew that if the Volkra found her, she would die. She had no light or fire with which to fight them. She had no weapons but her power. She'd taken the tiny craft and entered the dark alone in silence. She had traveled long miles to the broken remnants of Novokhribirsk.
Half the town was gone, swallowed by the darkness that reached all the way to the fountain in the main square. Zoya had run to her aunt's shop and found no one there. The door was unlocked. The chickens squawked in the yard. A cup of bergamot tea, Liliana's favorite, sat on the counter, long since gone cold. The rest of the town was quiet. A dog barked somewhere. A child cried. She could find no word of Liliana or her ward, until at last she spotted the same customer she'd seen that long-ago day in her aunt's shop.
"Liliana Guerin, have you seen her? Is she alive?"
The old customer's face paled.
She tried to help me when the darkness came. She pushed me out of the way so that I could run, if not for her.
Zoya had released a sob, not wanting to hear any more. Brave Liliana. Of course she had run toward the docks when the screaming began, ready to help. Why couldn't you be a coward this one time? Zoya could not help imagining the dark stain of the fold, bleeding over the town. The monsters descending from the air with their teeth and claws, shrieking as they tore her aunt apart. All her kindness had meant nothing. Her generosity. Her loving heart. She'd been nothing but meat to them. She'd meant even less to the Darkling. The man who had unleashed his horrors just to make a point. The man she had as good as worshipped.
"She should have let you die," Zoya spat at the old customer and turned her back on him.
She found a quiet street, curled up against a low stone wall and wept as she had not done since she was a child.
"Smile, beautiful girl," said a stranger passing. "We are still alive. There is still hope."
She snatched the air from his lungs and drove him to his knees.
"Smile," she commanded as his eyes watered and his face turned red. "Smile for me. Tell me again about hope."
Zoya left him on the ground, gasping. She'd made the crossing once more, silent and unnoticed in her craft, back to Krybirsk and the remnants of the Grisha camp. There she'd learned that the Darkling had raised his banner and called his loyal Grisha to him. Members of the Second Army were deserting, flocking to the Darkling's side or returning to Alsalta to try to mount a campaign against him. Zoya had stolen a horse and ridden through the night to the capital. She would find the Darkling. She would destroy him. She would take away his dream of ruling Ravka, even if she had to lead the Second Army herself. Zoya never told Alina the details of why she had chosen to fight beside her, why she'd turned against the man she'd once revered. It didn't matter. She'd stood shoulder to shoulder with the Sun Saint. They'd fought, and they'd won. They'd watched the Darkling burn.
"And still the wound bleeds," said the dragon. "You will never be truly strong until it closes."
"I don't want it to heal,"
Zoya said angrily, her cheeks wet with tears. Below, she saw the version of Novokrybirsk that existed in this twilight world, a black scar across the sands.
"I need it."
The wound was a reminder of her stupidity, of how readily she'd been willing to put her faith in the Darkling's promise of strength and safety, of how easily she'd given up her power to him. And no one had needed to force her down the aisle to make her do it. She'd done it gladly.
"You and I are going to change the world," he told her.
And she'd been fool enough to believe him.
"Zoya of the Lost City, Zoya of the Broken Heart, you could be so much more."
"Why didn't you come?"
she sobbed, surprised at the fresh tears that rose in her. She'd believed them long since shed.
"Why didn't you save her, all of them?"
"We didn't know what he intended."
"You should have tried."
She would always be that girl, weeping into her pillow, whispering prayers no one would answer. She would always be that child, dressed in gold, being led like an animal to slaughter. It was power that had saved her that day in the church, and that was what she had learned to rely on, to cultivate. but it had not been enough to save Liliana. After the war, she'd gone in search of Leda, hoping the child might have survived. She found no trace. Zoya would never know what had become of that bright-eyed, pug-faced girl.
"Can you forgive us?"
Joris asked.
"For being foolish, for being frail, for being fallible despite our great powers. Can you forgive yourself?"
"For loving the Darkling? For following him? For failing to save Liliana? For failing to protect the Second Army?" The list of her crimes was too long.
"Zoya,"
the dragon rumbled. It was less a spoken word than a thought that entered her head, a sense of eternity.
"Open the door. Connect your past to your future."
Zoya rested her head on the dragon's neck and felt strength flow through her. She heard her heart beating in time with his, slow and relentless, and beneath it a deeper sound, lower, one that touched everything. The sound of the universe, the making at the heart of the world. She wished she could be strong enough for this, but whatever Joris wanted from her, she could not find her way to it.
"You are the conduit, Zoya. You will bring the Grisha back to what they were meant to be before time and tragedy corrupted their power. But only if you can open the door."
"Why me?" she wondered.
"Because you chose this path. Because your king trusts you."
Joris tipped his wing and wheeled back to the palace.
"Because you are strong enough to survive the fall."
Chapter 26. Isaac. Isaac had passed on the information he'd gleaned from his conversation with Eri, though some part of him had felt a little dirty doing it. He'd shared every detail about the Tavgarad, and sure enough, Tamar's sources had been able to learn that one of them, a young recruit named Mayu Kirkat, had a twin brother who had also served in the Shu military. "He was stationed with a regiment in Koba," Tamar said, "but no one seems to be able to find him."
"Is that bad or good?"
Isaac wanted to know. "Good for us, bad for our Tavgarad guard," said Tamar. "We've tracked shipments of ruthenium to Koba. If her brother has been drafted into the Kirgud program, she may not be happy about it. Many candidates don't survive, and those that do are much changed." Isaac didn't know a lot about the Kirgud soldiers, only that they were rumored to be somewhere between man and killing machine.
"So if this guard, Mayu, is the defector," he said, "you'll initiate contact?"
"It won't be easy," said Tolia. "The Shu guards are rarely alone, but let us focus on that."
Tamar agreed. "We need you at your best for your meeting with the Kirch." And yet no amount of preparation could have readied Isaac for his disastrous encounter with Hiram Schenk. Isaac started the evening thrilled to be visiting the Gilded Bog, wondering what mad debauchery he might witness and if he'd get a glimpse of Count Kerrigan's wine cellars. They rode out with only a few soldiers, the twins, and Hiram Schenk and his guards. Despite the chill of the evening, Schenk had been giddy.
"This is most exciting, Your Highness," he said. "A fortuitous moment for both our countries."
He had the same ruddy coloring and auburn hair as his daughters.
"Indeed," said Isaac.
It was a very useful word. The Count greeted them in the gardens of his sparkling mansion, dressed in a vibrant crimson coat, the lapels studded with rubies the size of pullet eggs.
"Delighted to have you," he said in Hrothgar. "Welcome to my little hideaway."
"Thank you for your hospitality,"
Isaac said, as instructed.
"We knew we could count on your discretion."
"Always," said Kerrigan. "A necessity of statecraft and seduction alike. I have sent all of my house guests away, and the grounds are yours. When you finish with your revels, I hope you'll come restore yourselves by my humble hearth and share a cup of something warming."
Then he cleared his throat and lowered his voice.
I sent Commander Nazielensky an invitation to my autumn revels next week. I wonder if Your Highness might consider encouraging her to come.
Of course, said Isaac. She isn't currently in the capital, but I'm sure she'd be happy to join the fun.
Kerrigan blinked.
She would? Perhaps we should be on our way, Your Highness.
Interjected Tolia, shepherding Isaac away from the Count, who was looking at him strangely.
They'll be waiting for us at the lake.
Did I say something wrong? He whispered to Tolia as they rode down a gravel path lit by torches.
Zoya Nazielensky isn't happy to join Count Kerrigan for anything, said Tolia.
Tamar gave her reins a snap. Least of all fun. Jenya and David were waiting at the shores of an utterly dreary lake. They boarded a small sailing craft, a member of the Ravkin Royal Navy at the wheel. The night was still, and so a squaller stood at the mast, raised his hands, and filled the sail with wind. Above them, the night sky was lit by fireworks launched from somewhere on Kerrigan's grounds. Isaac wondered who they were for if all his guests were gone, but they created a lovely atmosphere. The boat came to a halt, bobbing gently. He could see a variety of other vessels moored not too far away, their sails lit by lanterns. No one seemed to be aboard.
As you know,
said Isaac in Kerch, reciting the speech Jenya and Tolia had prepared for him.
I've never been content with being confined to land. I have traveled the skies. I have ridden the sea. But then I began to wonder, why should the frontier that lies beneath the waves I love so well be closed to us? And so was born,
he swept his arm dramatically to port,
the Ismarzia.
The water beside the sailboat began to foam and surge. What looked like the back of a silver beast breached the surface. Isaac stifled a gasp. He wished the others had prepared him for the size of the thing. It dwarfed the sailboat.
Schenk grasped the railing, trying to take it all in. Incredible, he said. To think it was beneath us the whole time. Now let's see what it can do. Of course, said Isaac,
and lifted his hand to give the signal. The Ismarzia descended again, vanishing beneath the surface. All was quiet, the only sound the pop and whine of fireworks dotting the sky with cascades of light. Then a loud boom sounded from too close by. The water next to the boat nearest them exploded in a massive plume. The sleek-looking schooner listed starboard and collapsed. The lights from the lanterns catching in its sails and setting them ablaze, the craft began to sink, taking on water at an alarming rate, as if someone had ripped its hull wide open. Boom! Another boat collapsed, this one a huge old galleon. Another, a tidy clipper. Even if these craft had been manned and had attempted to mount some kind of defense, there was nothing to shoot at. There was no sign of the Ismarzia. Only the calm surface of the lake. A chill traveled through Isaac that had nothing to do with the cool night or the gloomy fog around the lake shore. So this was why the Kerch were so eager for these underwater ships. They could strike at any time, without risk to themselves, an invisible enemy. It was a frightening thought. Schenk was clapping his hands and whooping.
Stupendous! Better than I could have imagined. The Council will be thrilled. How long is the range? Can the missiles rupture a steel hull? What kind of fuel will we need?
Isaac didn't know how to answer. No one had prepared him for this kind of interrogation. He'd thought they would just offer a demonstration and then retire to Count Kerrigan's home to warm up.
All in due time, Isaac said,
or would have said. But he had not gotten the first word out when the Ismarzia breached the waters next to the sailboat with an ear-splitting roar. Its metal flank slammed into the sailboat, knocking Isaac and the others to the deck. Hiram Schenk screamed. The hull of the Ismarzia had cracked open, and the interior body of the ship was visible. It was filling with water, as the crew members shouted and tried to pull themselves up the metal walls. There was another loud boom, as its fuel tanks exploded into giant clouds of flame. Isaac heard a high whine, followed by another and then another. As the Ismarzia's missiles shot into the night sky, joining Kerrigan's fireworks. A stray missile grazed one of the sailboat's masts, snapping it in two. Isaac shoved Hiram Schenck aside before it could collapse on the merchant.
"Get us out of here,"
shouted the captain, and the squalor filled the remaining sails with wind, driving them swiftly to shore. The rest of the disaster was a blur, so